watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week on the program, we aired an extended report on the federal trial of four Ithaca-area peace activists known as the St. Patrick's Day Four. For those who've not yet heard, the following day, the jury in Binghamton returned a verdict of not guilty on the felony conspiracy charges, a big relief as those were the most severe. However, the jury convicted the four on misdemeanor charges of damage of government property and entering for illegal purposes. These convictions put four of Ithaca's finest citizens at risk of spending as much as 18 months in prison, a circumstance that outrages me, especially because an array of highly placed war criminals, liars, and racketeers, in other words, the federal government, face no consequences but bad opinion polls. Sentencing of the four will take place in January. Voters of Tompkins County, however, have the opportunity to pass judgment on District Attorney George Dentes, who referred the case of the St. Patrick's Four to the federal court after he could not gain a conviction in Tompkins County last year. Dentes has served as district attorney for Tompkins County since 1990 and has run without opposition in the past. But he now has a challenger, Gwen Wilkinson, who will take questions from the public at the next meeting of Back to Democracy. This will take place on this Thursday, October 6th, at 7 p.m. in Trumansburg in the large meeting room of the Village of Trumansburg office on Main Street. The event is free and open to everyone. The district attorney has great latitude as to whether to bring a case to trial and what charges to lay against a defendant. Since the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, Dentes' office has had a pattern of charging peace activists with the most severe charge remotely possible, then offering a plea bargain, a strategy apparently designed to maintain the 95% conviction rate which Dentes cites as evidence of his excellent job performance. This tactic failed to work against the St. Patrick's Four, who refused a plea bargain and went to trial. John Sherman, a locally elected judge, allowed the four to fully present their reasons for action and their belief that international laws against war crimes not only justified it, but required it. The defendants believe that had they had a similar opportunity in federal court, the jury would have responded in a similar fashion. Supporters of the St. Patrick's Day Four decided to focus a national spotlight on the issues of Iraq that motivated the defendants and organized a week-long citizens' tribunal. I promise to bring those sessions to you, and tonight we will hear the first panel, made up of two Americans and one Briton, all who served the establishment for decades, but broke ranks over the Iraq War. The panel was moderated by James Petrus, Professor Emeritus of Binghamton University, and an internationally regarded political analyst and author. His voice is the first you will hear.
We are meeting here in this tribunal to deal with issues of paramount importance that go far beyond the borders of this city, of this country. What are the issues that we face here? There are two versions. The versions that the federal trial will try to confine the defendants to, and the issues that will be raised at this parallel citizens' tribunal. According to the government, the St. Patrick's Four are charged with conspiracy, criminal trespass, and intimidation of federal officers carrying out duties. The response to that is there's no conspiracy. It was a public act of civil disobedience. There was no intimidation unless threats to officials, unless sending a divine message of peace can be interpreted as evoking the wrath of heaven on the lawmakers. Nothing of the sort. We must not let the federal court trivialize what is at stake here. According to many international jurists, the issues here include the unilateral declaration of an offensive war by the Bush administration against the UN Charter and international law, deliberate falsification of data presented as the pretext for war, willful deception of the sovereign people of the United States and its military forces as to the causes and consequences of the Iraq War, a systematic rejection of diplomatic means and methods designed to find a peaceful resolution to the alleged conflict with a defenseless country, engaging in a war resulting in crimes against humanity, including the death of over 100,000 Iraqis, pursuing a series of wars that willfully and deliberately increased the vulnerability of the United States and its allies to terrorism and natural disasters, accompanying the war with profound disregard for democratic freedoms enshrined in the Constitution, as evidenced in the Patriot Act and derivative judicial rulings allowing for the indeterminate jailing of U.S. citizens without charges, pursuing war through executive rulings which explicitly flaunt the Geneva Convention prohibiting torture and cruel and inhuman treatment of prisoners. Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo will go down in the infamous chapters of American history. Prioritizing military responses and definitions of political conflicts and reducing diplomatic responses to post hoc efforts to justify the unjustifiable. By making a shambles of diplomacy, Washington has established a precedent for other countries to shoot first and talk later. Notions of total war, unending wars, collective punishment, occupation and colonization are the ideological constructs of neoconservative advocates of world empire who place no limits on the sacrifice of U.S. lives at home and overseas. The issues raised by the St. Patrick Four are questions of whether we can reject the blind alley of endless wars and embrace a peaceful resolution of world conflicts based on justice, freedom, and self-determination of all peoples. We have with us tonight Ray McGovern, an ex-CIA man of 27 years, working now with justice groups in the United States. We have Anne Wright, former Foreign Service officer, who had the courage to resign in March 19, 2003, to protest the invasion of Iraq. and a violation. Yes, she had the courage to walk out, to say no, basta, up to here, no more. And we have Michael Meacher, a former minister of the environment between 1997 and 2003 in the British government of Tony Blair. They say Blair or Blair or Blyer. And a former member of parliament in England.
Current member.
Wonderful. It's even better. We have a current member of parliament with us this evening. Ray McGovern.
I'm reminded of a young priest friend of mine who was saying his first Mass, and he had everything all set. You know, he was really kind of, he had a wonderful sermon, and he had a lot of things going for him because his parish was very responsive. You know, forever and ever, amen, Lord be with you and also with you. But when he got up to the lectern or the pulpit, he got kind of nervous, and he thought it wasn't working. And so he said, God, there's something wrong with this thing. And also with you, was the immediate response. Well, there's something wrong with our government. Let me start out by just saying a word about Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Anne is one of our distinguished members. We have about 50 now from all agencies of the government having to do with intelligence. We chose the word sanity purposely because the people running our policy toward the Middle East displayed nothing of this quality. As a matter of fact, they were known in the 80s as, quote, the crazies, universally referred to in high government circles as the crazies who needed to be kept at middle levels. These are the Pearls, these are the Wolfowitzes, kept at middle levels so they wouldn't destroy the house. We could see what was happening. So we formed our group in January of 2003. We were very upset because, you know, believe it or not, the coin of the realm in the intelligence analysis business is to speak truth without fear or favor. We had career protection for telling it like it is. It was a real high. You know, we could go down to Henry Kissinger, as I was often sent down to, and to tell him what we thought, even if it was 180 degrees from what we thought or what he thought. When in Washington, you tell someone there's a place without a political agenda, you know, that people sort of, it's beyond their ken. I mean, they sort of, their shoulders shrug, you know, and they say, right, you know. And sort of reminds me of a terrible story that my Italian brother-in-law tells about us Irish. He asks, do you know why all Irishmen have droopy shoulders and flat foreheads? Anybody know? Because when you ask him a question, you always go, I don't know. You tell him the answer, they go, that's right. We wrote three memoranda before the war. The first was a same-day critique of Colin Powell's speech at the UN. We gave him an A for performance, a C-minus for content, and if we knew then what we know now, of course, we would have flunked him outright. It was a no-brainer. Where were the weapons of mass destruction? The U.S. was said to be giving its best evidence to the UN inspectors. The UN inspectors were implementing the most rigorous inspection regime in the history of the world, and they were finding nothing. No WMDs. Oops, they did find a couple of missiles that exceeded the range allowed. Do you remember that? That was in January of 2003. What happened? Anyone? What happened to those missiles? They were destroyed. They were destroyed before the UN inspectors. So it seems that Saddam Hussein was doing his part. but none could be found. Rumsfeld, of course, said, we know where they are. They're around Baghdad, Tikrit, north, east, south, and west of there. You know. This is the same guy that said, this has nothing to do with oil. The same fellow who said that the ties between al-Qaeda and the regime in Iraq were bulletproof, while Scowcroft, General Scowcroft, was saying that they were very tenuous indeed. So, what was the answer? Why we couldn't find any weapons of mass destruction? Well, obviously, they're terrible. They're very good at hiding things. So, the notion that they might not be there didn't occur to our leaders. Why? Well, because they had other reasons for this war. Now, the press, to my great regret, and this is the big sea change in my 40 years of watching things in Washington closely, we no longer have, in any real sense, a free press. The press led the cheerleading for the war, as you'll know. They gave the cowardly Colin high marks for his speech. They took everything that the White House gave them and published it on the first page of the New York Times and the Washington Post, a far cry from the days of the 70s in Watergate. What was the evidence that was adduced then? Well, when the administration top officials came back from summer vacation in 2002, they had already shared with our British colleagues the fact that there was going to be a war, that it would be, quote, justified by the conjunction of weapons of mass destruction, which there weren't any of, and ties with terrorists, which there are no ties, no matter. When the British foreign minister said, yes, but the evidence on weapons of mass destruction is thin, his word, thin, the head of British intelligence says, no, no problem. The evidence, the intelligence and the facts are being fixed around the policy. This is in black and white. You know, this is the Downing Street minutes. So no longer was there any doubt this was going to happen. The question was how to do it. And I can just, I wasn't in the Oval Office, but I can just visualize how the conversation went. You know, Labor Day is past now, and okay, we're going to have this war. So what we need to do? Let's get it going. Well, Mr. President, there's this Constitution thing. Constitution thing? What do you mean? Well, literally speaking, the power to declare or to authorize war is limited to the elected representatives of the people in the Congress and not you, sir. Well, okay. I guess we better do what my dad did and persuade the Congress. How are we going to do that? Well, they had no evidence, folks. All they had were a couple of aluminum tubes that were for mortar rockets or artillery rockets. And they had this story about Iraq seeking uranium in the African country of Niger. Now, when that story came in, my former colleagues in CIA dismissed it outright. Why? Because the government of Niger doesn't control the uranium mine in Niger. It's controlled by an international consortium headed by the French, and every ounce of that stuff is accounted for. There ain't no way that could happen. Ambassador Wilson went down there, verified all that. Still the story lived. And that story was used with our elected representatives in the Senate and the House of Representatives to trick our Congress out of their constitutional prerogative to declare war and then make them authorize this war. Don't take my word for this. Read the letter that Henry Waxman wrote to the president before the war. You see, it was clear that it was based on a forgery before the war. So what we have here really is two things. We have a report that's false on its face, and then we learned later it's based on a forgery. The thing that comes to mind is, some of you are too young to remember, Yul Brynner in The King and I. Remember that famous line where he sits back and he says, so, it's a false lie. That's what we had here, a false lie. Well, folks, the laughter stops when you realize this false lie was used with Congress to get them to vote for war. Henry Waxman wrote a letter to the president, a bitter letter to the president, in which he said, Mr. President, I voted for this war on the basis of your people briefing me about this report that Iraq was seeking uranium in Niger. How do you explain this? How do you explain that that this could happen? Guess what the date of that letter was, folks? March 17th, 2003. We, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, issued our third memorandum to the president on March 17th, 2003, the title of which was Forgery, Hyperbole, and Half-Truth. You've got a problem, Mr. President. Again, 2 days before the war. Sort of interesting, isn't it, how everything seems to happen on a good St. Patrick's Day. Suffice it to say that that we were doing our part. That is, Waxman was writing to the president in his letter. We wrote our memorandum to the president. But the St. Patrick's Four were doing something much more valuable. Because Martin Luther King, in his famous letter from the Birmingham City Jail, makes it clear that there comes a time when you have to put your flesh and blood into it to sensitize the conscience of the nation. And that's what you all did, you St. Patrick's Four, by taking your own blood, spilling it in a prominent place where you could serve a warning, serve a witness, saying, look, you may get upset about blood on the steps. Why are you not upset about so much blood that you could foresee happening in Iraq? 100,000 civilians would be alive today in Iraq were it not for this war. And of course, you know, we've reached 1,900 U.S. men and women killed in that war. So what I see is a prophetic statement by the St. Patrick's Four. And I think that that is an example of how one can speak out for justice. One can speak out not only against the horrors of war in and of itself, the brutalization that has accompanied this war, the torture. I just have to say that I thought torture would be one thing that all Americans could agree on. It's just never, never permitted. I mean, torture, in my view, is in the same category as rape, as slavery. Never mind that it doesn't work. As an intelligence officer, I know that. Never mind that it gives the country a black eye or that it puts our own soldiers at risk. It's just wrong, folks. And why our churches, for example, cannot find their voice? Why? I'm reminded of my good friend Dan McGuire, who teaches theology at Marquette University. And I think I'll pass this along because it seems so appropriate. He was teaching on sabbatical at Trinity College in Dublin. And it was a time when the Archbishop of Dublin had died. And there was a big buzz about whether the new replacement would be progressive and would be good. And so Dan was having lunch with a Presbyterian colleague of his, and the colleague said, Dan, I want you to know that I'm praying very hard that your new archbishop will not be progressive and will not be good. Dan said, well, why would you do that? And he said, well, because if it's not progressive and he's not good, then maybe you Catholics will finally become adults, live up to your baptismal promises, act like adults. A progressive bishop is the last thing you need. I take that for what it's worth. I just have to say that I am really in awe of what the Catholic Worker does, not only in its ministrations to the less fortunate, it's speaking with authority on matters of justice, and I'm referring to biblical justice now. Biblical justice, which is not unbiased, which is hopelessly prejudiced in favor of the poor. We have this in America, we have this. We have this symbol for justice, don't we? It's a blindfolded woman with scales, so she can't see which way to tip. You know, okay. Well, the biblical concept is like that in favor of the poor. The actual pre-Aramaic word for justice, tzedakah, has in its denotation showing mercy to the poor. So be aware that this biblical justice stuff is an anti-American activity, folks. Okay? And when you look at what the Vietnam War, yeah, the Vietnam War delivered the war on poverty, stillborn. Those of us around remember that, and we can see the same thing happening with the extraordinary expenditures being put on this feckless war in Iraq. So, following this example of Dorothy Day, the Catholic worker stays engaged, informed, readers of the signs of the times, and they followed the pre-war charade and saw through the disingenuousness of our government's statements and did their deed, for which I am in great admiration. And I think it no accident that St. Patrick, looking down from his new perch, must have thought in 2003, well, I wonder what kind of a day I'm going to have today. There'll be a nice parade in Dublin, and Friendly Sons of St. Patrick in New York will be whooping it up. But I wonder what kind of a day this will be for justice. Well, I think he's real happy. Not so much with Waxman's letter or our VIPS memo. I think he'd be really happy at the witness for justice that the St. Patrick's Four have given. A prophetic act. Now, how can I be so sure? Well, Americans don't read much anymore, but if one reads Paul O'Neill's memoirs, Richard Clark's memoirs, one can see that weapons of mass destruction had nothing to do with the war in Iraq, that it was those were all disingenuous explanations. And one could see that well before the documentary evidence that is available to us now in the Downing Street memos. So, where does this leave us? Well, it leaves me really angry. Really angry. I'm Irish, and that doesn't help. But, you know, when I was growing up, anger had a bad rap, you know. Angry for a day, maybe a week tops, and I found myself being, and my colleagues, not so much angry, well, angry indeed at the corruption of our profession, the corrupting of intelligence, but still more angry at the subversion of our constitutional process, folks. This is a constitutional crisis when you have one branch of government deliberately setting out successfully to deceive the other branch out of its rights in the Constitution. So luckily, in all this anger, I remembered that other people knew long before me that anger was getting a bad rap, and one of those was Thomas Aquinas. Now, at Fordham, we had to study so much of Thomas Aquinas that our colleagues in other colleges used to call us peeping Thomists. Aquinas had a lot of things wrong, like the status of women, but he got some things very right. And when he talked about virtue, he was right on the nose. He was very upset that there was no word in Latin for the virtue of anger. Okay? The virtue of anger. He said The word for anger, manati nominata, remains unnamed. And he quoted John Chrysostom from the early church, who said, he or she who is not angry when there is just cause for anger sins. Okay? Why? Because anger... because anger looks to the good of justice. And if you can live amid injustice without anger, you are unjust. That's what Chrysostom said. And Aquinas added this. He railed against what he called unreasoned patience. Now, that's the best we can do out of the Latin. Unreasoned patience. But think about what that might mean, unreasoned patience. Aquinas said, unreasoned patience sows the seeds of vice, nourishes negligence, and encourages not only evil people, but good people to do evil. So, what do you think of first when you think of unreasoned patience? Well, I think of Germany in 1939 and earlier in the 30s. I was born in 1939, 1 week before Hitler sent his tanks into Poland to start World War II, and I have a certain bizarre affinity for that year. I've also lived in Germany for 5 years and had all manner of opportunity to ask the Germans why it was. Why was it? How could it have been that you, among the most cultured, the most educated people in the Western world, how could you have let this happen? How could you not find your voice? Why is it that your churches, the Evangelical Lutheran Church, your Catholic churches, why is it that they said nothing? I never got a good answer to that. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, of course, was one that did speak out and was killed. But there was another gentleman that you may not know about, and I'd like to just tell his story very briefly before closing. His name was Albrecht Haushofer, and he was a geologist at the University of Berlin. Those of you who have tenure know what tenure is like. He had a pretty good deal there, and he didn't speak out before the war, but when Hitler started invading other countries, he spoke out strongly, often was wrapped up and sent to prison like Bonhoeffer. Now, the SS, in typically German methodical practice, was required to extract a confession from people before they shot him or before they hanged him, but Haushofer wouldn't cooperate. But after they shot him anyway, and when they picked him off the floor, out of his pocket fell a little piece of paper, and it was his confession, and it was written in the form of a sonnet. The title was Schuld, which is the German word for guilt. Doch bin ich schuldig, aber anders als ihr denkt. Yeah, I'm guilty, but it's not what you're thinking. Ich musste früher meine Pflicht erkennen. Ich musste schärfer Unheil, Unheil nennen. I should have earlier recognized my duty. I should have schärfer, more sharply, called Unheil, called evil, evil. Mein Urteil habe ich zu lang gelenkt. My judgment I put off far too long. Ich habe gewarnt, I did warn, aber nicht genug und klar. Genug is enough. Klar, claro, klar. There's no comparative in German for klar. Klar is klar, okay, clear. So, nicht genug und klar, und heute weiß ich, was ich schuldig war, and today I recognize what I was guilty of. I think we need to ponder those words because, as Martin Luther King said in his famous speech on Vietnam, there is such a thing as too late. There is such a thing as too late. And to further challenge us and to show in the light of the St. Patrick's Four that it is possible to measure up, let me quote the words of a poet I know named Daniel Berrigan. We have assumed the name of peacemakers, but we have been, by and large, unwilling to pay any significant price. And because we want peace with half a heart, half a life, half a will, the war, of course, continues. He's talking Vietnam. Because the waging of war, by its very nature, is total, but the waging of peace, by our own cowardice, is partial. So a whole will and a whole heart and a whole national life bent on toward war prevail over the vaities of peace. Of course, let us have peace, we cry, but at the same time, let us have normalcy. Let us lose nothing. Let our lives stand intact. Let us know neither prison, nor ill repute, nor disruption of ties. There is no peace because there are no peacemakers. There are no makers of peace because the making of peace is at least as costly as the making of war, at least as exigent, at least as liable to bring disgrace and prison, and even death in its wake. I will close with a quote that reminds me of a couple of things. I think it's originated with Dante, but it says that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who remain neutral in times of crisis. I think we have a crisis moment here. I think it is also what we would say is a Kairos moment. And I would just warn about, you know, those of us who have been in Crawford, Texas this past August, I understand that hell is even hotter than Crawford. Thank you very much.
Former CIA analyst Ray McGovern.
Our next speaker is the dynamic Anne Wright.
Thank you. Thanks. Well, these two guys have kind of led me into one little thing. Ray's talking about how hot it was in Crawford, and you're talking about volunteers to go downstairs. Well, I was the camp commandant at Camp Casey, and it reminds me every single night we were asking for volunteers to do something. So really, now, come on, we've got to help. Somebody's got to go down there and do those dishes. And if you don't do it, then I have to do it. That was pretty much the way. So it is so true. I mean, all of the things that we're doing right now are because individuals like you are coming out to stand up and stand for something, to stand for peace in our country and to stop this war. What the St. Patrick's Day Four did in March of 2003, they were standing up right then to say this government has to stop this war, and we're willing to put our lives in jeopardy. And little did we actually know what type of political retribution and retaliation would really start coming. And it's one thing, you know, you have a trial on this. Okay, fine. Somebody goes into a federal building. They put their blood down. There are charges that are brought against them. In a court of law, in the state court, those charges are acquitted from it. So fine, okay, the court system works. But here in America, all of a sudden, we're finding that there's a lot of retaliation, a lot of retribution. So if the state court can't get them, by golly, here comes the federal court. Well, I'll tell you what, we the people of the United States have to be standing up and standing with you guys right here. This sort of stuff, if it happens to them, it's going to happen to us. So no matter who you are and what you've been doing, you better watch your back, because somebody's after it right now in this day and time in America. And I really hate to say that, because I served America for 35 years for seven administrations elected by us, the people of the United States. And I mean, there are plenty of times in every administration that I held my nose on some of the programs and policies that each one of them had, because, you know, as individuals, we don't always agree with every single thing that the people that you may have voted for even cooked up. But I'll tell you, in March of 2003, just like our colleagues here, when they stood up in the recruitment center and they poured their vials of blood as their stand against what they knew was going to be a terrible tragedy for our country. I was living in Mongolia at the time. Yeah, far away Mongolia. This was after I'd been in Afghanistan. I'd helped reopen our embassy in Afghanistan in December of 2001. I'd served in places like Sierra Leone, Somalia, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Grenada, Nicaragua, Panama. And you probably think, good God, why did it take her so long to finally resign? But, you know, I mean, everybody in the world knew for the United States to invade and occupy an oil-rich Arab country. I mean, how dumb could that be? How stupid could that be for the world, for the security of the United States? I mean, we knew exactly what was going to happen. We knew that that would infuriate, as it should, the rest of the people of the world and Muslims throughout the world, from all the way from Asia, all the way back across South Asia, into the Middle East, back into the Western Hemisphere, up into Europe. Muslims of all sorts were saying, why are you going in and invading that country? It didn't do anything to you. Well, we knew what was going to happen, that people would be infuriated and they would go after the people, the invaders, the infidels, and that's us. And right now, you might as well just put a big old target, a bullseye, on the back and front of every American that's in there, because they are the targets. And there will not be any peace in that country until the United States gets itself out of there.
Former diplomat Anne Wright.
Ray mentioned that Crawford, Texas. Well, I've been there for 26 days with old Cindy Sheehan. I mean, talk about one crazy lady. You know, you lose your son, you lose your members of your family, and you say, I want to talk. Crazy, crazy, crazy. Right. I would like to talk to the President of the United States that took us to war about why this is such a noble war, why this is a noble cause, why the death of my son was noble. So she did kind of a strange thing. She went out to the pasture lands of Texas and said, I'm sitting here in the 105-degree weather until the President comes out to talk to me, or until I get arrested here, or until the August 31st comes to pass. Well, there were about 150, 200 of us in Dallas when she made that statement at the Veterans for Peace Conference. She said, I'm going to Crawford tomorrow. This was about 9:30 at night on Friday she made the statement. I'm leaving for Crawford tomorrow at 8:30. I need a ride. Can somebody give me a ride to Crawford? Well, you know, we were sitting there just kind of like you all are right now. And so what happened? Well, it was like every one of you raised your hands. It's, okay, I'll go. I'll take you. I want to find out what the President's going to say. So the next morning, a convoy to Crawford. Off we went. And then 26 days later, we were still waiting for the number one public servant of the United States to come talk to Cindy, but by that time it had grown to talk to you, to talk to the American people about what's going on. Well, there's a chicken in Crawford. The chicken didn't come out to talk. I mean, can you believe it? How easy would that have been for the President of the United States to say, or maybe for his advisors to say to the President of the United States, you know, there's one quick, easy way to get rid of that lady and those, you know, at that time, maybe 15 or 20 people that had stayed the first night, and then let's go talk to her, you know, let's get this over with. Or maybe Laura Bush could have come over and said, would you like some lemonade or something? You know, it's a little hot. Well, we didn't get anything from the White House. Well, actually, the National Security Advisor did make a comment, but might as well go for the gusto. Let's get the top guy. Well, 26 days later, Zipola. Nothing from the administration, but one heck of a lot from you, the American public, and remarkably from the media. Can you believe it? You even heard about it. You heard about voices of dissent, voices of opposition in our country. My God, how in the world could that happen? I mean, I resigned in March of 2003, and I don't think anybody in America really heard about it. It got much more publicity in Europe. There, very little. I was one of three diplomats that resigned, one of three federal employees that had resigned. Only three of us. There weren't many. It wasn't a big splash, but certainly the media didn't give us much play at all on that, nor did the voices of opposition in the succeeding months. I mean, how many of you all marched either before the war started or after the war started? Yeah, good for you. And how many are going to be in Washington this coming weekend? Yes, we need to close that city down. All of you guys, there's no reason to be in Binghamton. There's no reason to be in New York. Everybody needs to converge on Washington to put pressure, because we need to bring our troops home now. We need to get them out of Iraq. There's not one thing that we can do. I mean, the Iraqis are perfectly capable people. I must say I'm glad Saddam Hussein is not in the mix right now, but that said, the Iraqi people are very capable of taking care of their own affairs. It may not be a perfect solution, and it may not be it's going to be difficult for them. There's no doubt about it, especially when you have to recover from a country that has now been destroyed by the war that the United States created and prosecuted on them. So we've got our mission here, just as in March of 2003, where the St. Patrick IV's mission was to call attention of the world to an illegal act that our country was committing. And they, using the Nuremberg principles that said that citizens have the obligation and responsibility to stand up and try to stop illegal acts of its government. They tried it. They were out there with their bodies to say, stop this war. Don't let this war go on. And now they're being tried for a second time in an act of retaliation and retribution. So we stand here with them to stop the government, in this political act, using the judicial system, using prosecutors and judges in ways that we never thought were going to be possible in our country. But we are at a crisis in our country. There are so many things of our social fabric, our judicial fabric, that are being undermined. So you can't stay here in Binghamton this weekend. You have to come to Washington. If you don't come to Washington, I mean, what are we going to do? If we don't get a lot of people down there, you know what George Bush and Karl Rove and all of them are going to say? Got them again. They don't care. We'll just watch this next one. God knows what they'll pull on us. So it's the voice of opposition, the voices of dissent that finally are getting some play. Just these last 6 weeks, we've started getting some play. With going to Crawford, sitting in the ditch, now we've got three buses that are crossing the United States, converging in Washington, 27 states, 51 cities, that we've been met with a lot of people of America who are finally saying, it's time for us to make a difference. It's time to stand up to this government. So on behalf of the people of America, we thank you all who started on March 17th of 2003 to highlight the illegality of this war. We are in solidarity with you. We'll be standing with you. If anything happens, there will be plenty of people with you all the way along. So with that, I want to thank all of you all for your solidarity to be here. It has been a pleasure to be with you all today. And not only do we need to stay here in Binghamton for this trial, but then on the weekend, let's all head for Washington and really put some pressure on this government. Thank you.
Former diplomat Ann Wright.
Well, I've come an even longer way, and very glad to do so in order to put pressure on this government. I've come from the UK in order to support the St. Patrick's Four because because I believe that the Iraq war is a watershed in international relations on which everyone who seeks a new and better world order built on peace and understanding between nations has got to take a stand. And that is what they have done. I say this partly because this was an unprovoked war. That is beyond question. It was an illegal war because there never was a second UN resolution beyond 1441. And the lawyers will tell you that that was necessary to make it legal. And it was a dishonest and unjust war because, as we now know, the grounds put forward by both the US and UK governments were false, and what is also something we now know, they knew them to be false at the time that they were propagating them.
Michael Meacher, Member of Parliament, former Minister of the Environment in the Blair government.
But I say this is also a watershed because of the consequences with which we are now faced. A bloody and unending insurgency against which I believe the war is unwinnable, and it will not end until foreign occupation forces are withdrawn from that country. And because of another consequence, and that is the erosion of those basic fundamental rights and liberties which the St. Patrick's Four so poignantly symbolize, which actually undermine the very freedoms which the so-called War on Terror was supposed to defend. Now, I think both of these cry out for a fundamental change of course and a calling to account, which has not yet happened, of the political leaders who have taken us down this disastrous course. The first and prime grounds for accountability is the duplicity with which the American and British peoples were engineered into this war under false pretenses. And I just want to tell you briefly what happened in Britain, which I think is very similar to what happened in this country. There were four grounds which were given by the Prime Minister to justify bringing Britain into the war. First of all, he presented Parliament with a huge infantry of chemical and biological weapons, which he claimed were held by Saddam Hussein. But what he omitted to say is that these were simply weapons unaccounted for at the end of the first Gulf War, not necessarily possessed by Saddam Hussein, and of course, as it turned out, they didn't exist. But again, what is really significant, which we now know, is that Britain's intelligence services were telling the Prime Minister before the war that they might well not exist. So he knew that at that time. Secondly, he claimed that Saddam Hussein had the capability to launch weapons of mass destruction within 45 minutes. A claim which I can tell you produced an immense stir in my country. And that the threat was serious and growing. What he didn't say is that this all came from one single source, that it was uncorroborated, an extremely bad source, and one that was totally unreliable. And of course, the claim was completely fanciful, as we now know. Thirdly, he continued to claim, and Ray referred to this, that Iraq had tried to buy 500 tons of uranium yellowcake from Niger for nuclear weapons purposes, in order to give the impression, of course, that there was a nuclear program in Iraq, even though it was known then to both the US and the UK governments that a visit had been made to Niger by a former US ambassador, I think it was Joseph Wilson, 6 months before, which had confirmed, and he spent a week there investigating, that the claim was completely bogus. That was known, and yet it went into the dossier to persuade the British Parliament and the British people, and I believe it was also mentioned by President Bush in his State of the Union speech in January, just before the war. Fourthly, the Prime Minister claimed in the House of Commons 1 month before the war, this is rather less well known, but I think it is a devastating fact, that when Hussein Kemal, who was the son-in-law of Saddam Hussein, defected to the West in 1995, he had revealed, and I quote the words of the Prime Minister, the offensive biological weapons and full extent of the nuclear program, unquote. Unfortunately for him, Newsweek got hold of the debriefing a few weeks later and discovered that what he actually said was exactly the opposite. And I quote again, all weapons, biological, chemical, missile, nuclear, were destroyed, unquote. Those are the words of his son-in-law, the man who was in charge of the program. There could hardly be a better source. And that was known to your government and my government in 1995, 8 years before this war. Now, the second reason, that's why I liked what Ray said about anger. I find it difficult to conceal my anger because we were tricked into this war, not on the basis of guesses, which might have been right, but on the basis of claims which were known to be wrong. And I think that is unforgivable. Now, the second reason for demanding accountability from the government is, of course, that the real reason for launching this war has never, even now yet officially been admitted. It was nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction. You remember Richard Perl, a neocon name that will be known very well to you. When he was presented with the evidence that we can't find any WMD, what did he say? It's nothing to do with WMD. It never was. That was never the issue. But it was the issue that was used in order to try and dupe the British and American peoples. It was nothing to do with 9/11. Despite Donald Rumsfeld's repeated attempts to pin it on Saddam Hussein, there has never been a shred of evidence ever anywhere to suggest that there was any link between 9/11 and Iraq and Saddam Hussein. It wasn't even about stopping terrorism. I know President Bush likes to say that we're fighting in Iraq in order to prevent the fight being brought onto the home front. Well, tell that to the people of London and Madrid. But the fact is, it never was about stopping terrorism. The fact is, there never was any terrorist. There never were any suicide bombers in Iraq before the United States and the British invaded and occupied Iraq. And what, again, is something very significant, we now know that MI6, which is the British Intelligence Service, warned the British Prime Minister that, in fact, this is pure common sense, but it's very significant that they said it, and they said it to him before the war, that invading Iraq would enhance international terrorism, not diminish it. Again, this was a warning which was not made public at that time, and we only found out about it afterwards. And it was nothing to do with human rights abuses by Saddam Hussein, horrendous and terrifying though those were. I quote as evidence from the manifesto of the Bush administration, published in September 2000, the Project for the New America Century document, which makes clear, and I quote again, the need for a substantial American force presence transcends the issue of the regime of Saddam Hussein. And if you haven't understood what that means, it goes on, and I quote again, even though Saddam Hussein should pass from the scene, unquote, U.S. bases in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait would remain permanently. No. The real underlying reason for this war, which has cost 100 British lives, 2,000 American lives, though I think if you include those soldiers who died subsequently of their wounds, the figure is nearer 8,000, I'm told, and perhaps up to 100,000 Iraqi lives. The reason for this is oil. It was a war which was planned, as we now know, from the very first days of the Bush administration. The evidence of that comes from Paul O'Neill, President Bush's first Treasury Secretary, who's authoritatively told us that. And all they needed was a pretext. That is what they were looking for, a pretext in order to launch it. And as this Downing Street memorandum of the middle of 2002, 6-8 months before the war, makes clear, the decision to go to war had already been taken long before. And what the UK and the US, after that fateful meeting between Tony Blair and George Bush at the Crawford Ranch in April 2002, what they were doing was simply looking for grounds, for causes, justifications to be cobbled together in order to fit with a political and military strategy which had already been adopted. And that strategy was about getting control of most of the world's remaining oil, because the oil is already beginning to run out.